And Radio Dub is on the air. Welcome, listeners. As usual at this time of year, I am podcasting to you from Baltimore, where I am attending the annual meeting of the H.L. Mencken Club. The boss, Peter Brimelow, is here, and so are many other worthies of the dissident right persuasion. One consequence of my location is that I'm far away from VDare.com's state-of-the-art sound studio in Long Island. Instead, I am recording here in my room at the BWI Sheraton Hotel. That accounts for the occasional noises off. Traffic sounds, gurgling water pipes, doors slamming, muffled screams, random gunshots, and so on. Please don't let them distract you. Right now, it's late Friday evening. The only actual conference event so far was the opening reception at 6 o'clock, but there's a busy schedule of talks and discussion groups tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to that. Meanwhile, some tidbits from the week's news. What do you say, Ethel?
Let's go on with the show!
Chapter 4 of Charles Dickens' novel Bleak House bears the title Telescopic Philanthropy. This chapter introduces us to the character Mrs. Jellyby, who, from her home in London, devotes all her energies to the welfare of, quote, the natives of Borioboola-Gha on the left bank of the Niger, end quote. Meanwhile, Mrs. Jellyby neglects her own house and her own children. Her attention, her interest, and all her energies are concentrated on Africa, on the natives of Borioboola-Gha. This is what Dickens satirizes as telescopic philanthropy. Following the murder of 9 Americans, 3 mothers and 6 children, in Mexico on Monday, just 50 miles south of the American border, it's dawning on ordinary Americans that our administration, with full support from both our big political parties, is dedicated to telescopic foreign policy. Our eyes, like Mrs. Jellyby's, scan the far horizon, seeking out matters we can involve ourselves in and spend our money on. Meanwhile, here at home, our cities clog up with homeless, unelected judges make a mockery of the democratic process, foreign scofflaws pour in across our borders, and our citizens die in tens of thousands every year from illegal drugs. Those 9 Americans died while our fool administration was still crowing about a special forces mission in Syria. And while also, of course, our war in Afghanistan chugged into its 19th year, and tens of thousands of our troops continued to garrison rich and populous nations like Germany and South Korea that are perfectly well able to manage their own defences. Telescopic philanthropy. But while Mrs. Jellyby's telescopic philanthropy, however foolish, was at least private, spending no one's money but her own, neglecting no one's property and children but her own, ours is a squandering of our national wealth and resources to no national advantage. We had elections this week for various kinds of state and local positions. The results were mixed, pluses and minuses, but it looked to me like mostly minuses. On the plus side, voters in Washington state rejected a measure to legalize affirmative action. Precisely, a yes vote would, quote, allow affirmative action policies by the state of Washington in the areas of public education, public employment, and public contracting, as long as such policies do not constitute preferential treatment, as defined, and do not use quotas. End quote. Of course, the entire point of affirmative action is to give preferential treatment to favored groups. And quotas are the only way you can do this without risking legal trouble. Everybody understands this, but everybody has to pretend not to. Thanks to the voters of Washington State, well, 52% of them, for giving a good kick in the shins to this whole dishonest sham. And then voters in Tucson, Arizona, voted down an initiative that would have made Tucson a sanctuary city. This initiative was in reaction to the famous law passed in 2010 by the state legislature and signed by then-Governor Jan Brewer, giving state law enforcement powers to help enforce federal immigration laws. Critics, of course, struck down most of the law, but left it okay for officers to check a suspect's immigration status. The idea of this initiative was to kill that last surviving portion of the 2010 law, to finish the job the critics left unfinished. Instead, voters killed the initiative, leaving the law standing. This wasn't a 50-50 decision either. More than 70% of Tucson voters said no to the sanctuary city idea. Well done, Tucson. Sanctuary much. Good news from Texas, too. Texas is just one of seven states without a personal income tax. Pop quiz, how many of the other six can you name? The Texas state constitution says there can only be a state income tax if it's approved by a majority of legislators and a majority of voters in referendum. Well, Texans voted by nearly 75% to 25% for an amendment raising that simple majority of legislators to two-thirds, while still requiring also a majority of voters. So, with the state constitution thus amended, now it's even harder than it was before to get an income tax passed in Texas. So, some nice pluses there, but nationwide, most of the news was bad for President Trump and his party. In Virginia, Democrats now control both houses of the state legislature for the first time in 26 years. Republican losses in Pennsylvania inspired the Associated Press report to descriptives like blue wave and catastrophic. The GOP candidate for governor of Kentucky lost in spite of Trump having staged a big rally in his support on Monday night. He only lost by a whisker, less than half of 1%, but still, Kentucky! So it goes. There's a pattern, though, if you look for it. So, at any rate, says Daniel Horowitz over at Conservative Review. I shall let him explain. Edited quotes. On critical issues, especially on issues like immigration and crime, Republicans are not as emphatically to the right as Democrats are to the left. How else do you explain, on the one hand, Republican issues winning overwhelmingly in urban and very Hispanic Tucson, but on the other hand, GOP candidates losing tremendous ground in suburbs, even in red states like Mississippi? voters in no way support the extreme agenda of the Democratic Party. Certainly not those living in suburban neighbourhoods in the South. But the Republican Party is a terrible vehicle for promoting a bold contrast. End quote. I would chop that last sentence down from 11 words to 5. The Republican Party is terrible. I think Daniel Horowitz has caught on to an important truth there. As a great political analyst once said, when people see a strong horse and a weak horse, by nature, they will like the strong horse. The Democratic Party is the strong horse here. Their ideas are wrong-headed, frequently crazy, but they pursue political victory with vigour and conviction. The Republicans are the weak horse. They have much more sensible ideas, but they are hobbled by their globalist business donors, and they half believe the cant out of media and the academy that national sovereignty, demographic stability, and realism about sex and race are immoral. Democrats are bold and loud. Republicans are timid and apologetic. Strong horse, weak horse. Back there, I quoted from one of Daniel Horowitz's pieces at Conservative Review. As it happens, I attended a talk by Daniel last week in New York City. I was introduced to him beforehand. He knew who I was. We exchanged a few cordial pleasantries. Then I enjoyed listening to him give a fine, spirited talk about immigration and judicial arrogance. Daniel actually wrote a book on the latter topic, about what we at VDare.com call the Critarchy, back in 2016, co-authoring with Michael Levin. Stolen Sovereignty is the title, and I commend it to your attention. Although I think that with a federal judge somewhere issuing an injunction every time Donald Trump blows his nose, I think that an updated edition might be a good idea. So, put me down as a fan of Daniel Horowitz. Unfortunately, he labours under the disadvantage that his first initial and his surname are the same as those of David Horowitz, editor of the venerable conservative website frontpagemag.com. Naturally, the younger Horowitz, Daniel, gets confused with the older one, David. I have no idea whether or not they are related. Confusions of this kind are distressingly common in public life. Permit me to quote from one of my old straggler columns at National Review. This was July 2006. The subject of the column was Letters to the Editor. Quote from the straggler, quote, "A personal favourite of mine is the one sent to the London Times in February 1959, signed jointly by Earl Russell, a.k.a. Bertrand Russell, the philosopher and gadfly, and Lord Russell of Liverpool, a jurist who had helped prosecute the Nazi defendants at Nuremberg. After the latter's book, The Scourge of the Swastika, became a bestseller, people started getting the two aristocratic Russells mixed up, leading to the joint letter, whose text read in its entirety, in a quote, "In order to discourage confusions which have been constantly occurring, we beg herewith to state that neither of us is the other." End in a quote. There you have a perfect letter to the editor. Memorable, socially useful, and brief. End quote. If you're wondering how England could have two lords named Russell, it's because one of them, the philosopher, was an earl, while the other one, the jurist, was only a baron. That's two rungs lower on the aristocratic ladder. If you yearn to know more, I refer you to the classic reference work on British titles, Debrett's Peerage, Baronetage, Knightage and Companionage. Another instance of this confusion showed up on Twitter the other day. Robert Spencer, author of numerous books about the Middle East and principal of the website jihadwatch.org, Robert Spencer issued a tweet along the same lines as that letter to the Times 60 years ago from the two Lords Russell. Tweet from Robert Spencer. I see that Richard Spencer is trending. I have no idea why, but this is likely to move a lot more idiots and trolls to confuse us. This is a reminder that Richard and Robert are not the same name, and I am not Richard. Thank you in advance for understanding. End tweet. Your onomastically genial host here has been involved in similar confusions. Jonathan Derbyshire, an opinion page editor at the Financial Times, is constantly pestered by people mistaking him for the proprietor of Radio Derb, which has, of course, a much higher profile among the opinion-seeking public. In a spirit of collegial magnanimity, I have offered to relieve Jonathan of the annoyance by changing my name, in return for a modest sum of money. But Jonathan has so far not responded to my offer. There was even another rising star in opinion journalism with precisely the same name as myself. Another John Derbyshire. A young fellow, not long out of college. This other John Derbyshire even started up a weekly podcast in competition with Radio Derb. Unfortunately, the young man suffered a fatal automobile accident while visiting Turkmenistan at the personal invitation of my dear friend, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. A real tragedy. So young, so talented. The phrase, ladies and gentlemen, is being expunged from public speech as insufficiently gender fluid. I had an item on this 2 weeks ago. That referred to a ruling by Air Canada that they will no longer say ladies and gentlemen or mesdames et messieurs when addressing airplane passengers en masse. To do so would apparently be de trop. If not, un outrage à la pudeur. I don't know how much further French speakers will take this, but it's spreading like wildfire through the Anglosphere. Here's a news item from Britain, dated November 3rd. Actors over there in Shakespeare's Island have a labour union called Equity. Last week, this union issued guidelines for theatres and such, banning the phrase ladies and gentlemen. The actual Royal Shakespeare Company snapped to attention, putting out a statement saying that they will, quote, strive to create environments which welcome and support trans people and people who identify their gender as fluid. End quote. Other production companies have been ahead of the curve. Last year, Britain's National Youth Theatre staged a production of Macbeth, featuring a female Macbeth married to a female Lady Macbeth. And two of the three witches were males, although one of them was wearing a tutu and apparently nothing else. And yes, that distant grinding sound you hear is the bard himself turning in his grave. The expurgation of ladies and gentlemen may not be limited to the Anglosphere. As a sidebar to these stories, although I'll admit of strictly limited interest, I wonder if China is going woke. When I lived there 36 years ago, the usual mode of address to a mixed-sex gathering was "同志们," which means comrades. When I next visited 18 years later, the word "同志" had well nigh disappeared from ordinary usage. I was hearing "先生们、女士们," which means gentlemen and ladies. This year, that's a further 18 years on, "同志" has, as I reported in my May diary, has been appropriated by homosexuals. If you address a guy in mainland China as "同志," he will either sock you on the jaw or invite you back to his place to look at his collection of Liza Minnelli videos. "先生们、女士们" is still current, but I thought I was hearing a lot of the sex-neutral style "各位大家," which is a polite way of saying "everybody." So, is China going woke? That would be an interesting development. I wasn't there long enough this year to form a definite opinion, so I'd be glad to hear input from people more familiar with today's China, or from other people outside the Anglosphere. How seriously should the public authorities take racism? Not seriously at all, is my opinion. Racism, on the dictionary definition, is just an opinion about our species, Homo sapiens. I wouldn't say there are no instances at all when the authorities should be interested in citizens' opinions, but the number of such instances is very small. Out at the furthest extremes of terrorist and criminal activity, and we should keep it that way. If a person is partial to some races over others, that's no business of the state. It's just an opinion. Likewise, if he makes himself obnoxious in public to people of other races, he should be scolded and shamed by his fellow citizens, as we do with other displays of bad manners. Again, no business of the state. Of course, if there's a major breach of public order, or the person goes burning crosses on people's front lawns, or beating people up, or bombing churches, he should be dealt with under the appropriate laws dealing with assaults on property or persons. These are the basic understandings of civilized life in a free society. We are losing them fast. Case in point. A hospital in Bristol, in the southwest of England, is going to withdraw treatment from patients who use, quote, "racist or sexist language, gestures or behaviour," end quote. There will be a process like those used at soccer games. For a first offence, you'll be shown a yellow card. If the bad manners continue, you'll get a red card. Then your treatment will be, quote, "withdrawn as soon as is safe," What does that mean? The point where it's safe to withdraw treatment is the point where you're cured, isn't it? In which case the hospital will be discharging you anyway. Perhaps they mean that you'll be suffering pain or disability, but your condition won't get any worse after treatment's withdrawn. Hard to see how that can be squared with the Hippocratic Oath. A statement from the hospital says that, quote, "The hospital will also be calling for staff to join its Black, Asian and minority ethnic network to champion the approach and to provide support to any affected staff," end quote. I can surmise what's going on here. Hospital patients include a good proportion of old and very old people. Citizens who grew up before the infinite delicacy of modern racial etiquette settled in. Citizens, furthermore, not always in total possession of their faculties. Hospital staff, on the other hand, now include a high proportion of non-whites from decades of third world immigration. Working the wards, they don't always encounter the careful deference from white people that they're used to outside the hospital. So now, if some geezer keeps mumbling that he'd rather be attended by an English doctor, he can have his treatment withdrawn. And that's a good thing. Everyone, repeat after me. Diversity is our strength. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. One of the worst blots on Donald Trump's presidency, to my way of thinking, has been his treatment of Jeff Sessions. Sessions was in the Senate arguing the agenda that Trump ran on in 2016, long before Trump declared his candidacy. He was one of Trump's earliest supporters. As Attorney General, he did his best, in the teeth of opposition from the judiciary and established bureaucracy, he did his best to see that the people's laws on immigration were enforced. In return, Trump insulted and belittled him endlessly. A shameful display of ingratitude and bad manners. Sessions took it all like the gentleman he is, putting the integrity of our government and the good of our country first. After leaving office, he told no tales and spoke no ill of anyone. Jeff Sessions is a rare gem. He told us on Thursday this week that he'd be back running for his old Senate seat next November for the state of Alabama. I hope he gets it. And if the president doesn't want to support him, I hope Trump will at least have the decency to just keep his mouth shut. Item. I'm always interested in developments at Williams College, the liberal arts school in Williamstown, Massachusetts, whose president had a nervous breakdown in 2016 because a student group at the college invited me to speak there. Well, here's the latest from there. Quote, "Students at Williams College have launched a boycott of the entire English department, claiming the curriculum is whitewashed and its scholars racist. Joined by alumni and others, the Boycott English effort calls on the students of Williams College to boycott the entire English department, according to the activists' lengthy online missive. Their main complaints include allegations of scholars using, oh my God, the N-word, a curriculum that prioritizes white authors over authors of color, and claims that professors of color are not given tenure at the private and preppy Massachusetts institution," end quote. The college is as woke as it is possible to be. faculty includes two self-described black queer feminists, one of them teaching Introduction to Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, the other teaching Black Literature Matters. Annual tuition at Williams is $57,000, so a four-year degree will cost you nearly $250,000. So here's my question. What on earth, what in God's good earth is going through the minds of parents writing $250,000 checks so their kids can spend 4 years in this lunatic asylum and come out with a BA in English? Item. In last week's podcast, I rattled off four different ways to describe the great cultural split that is reshaping our politics. Blues and reds, globalists and nationalists, cosmopolitans and communitarians, metropolitans and provincials. A listener emailed in to grumble that I had omitted the descriptors used by the blogger Z-Man, which he, I mean the listener, liked better than any of mine. Z-Man calls the two sides cloud people and dirt people. I agree that those are indeed excellent descriptors, and I shall include them in future lists. Item. Finally, just when you think we've hit peak crazy, something comes along to disabuse you. This week it was a story at Breitbart.com about a Christian hymn society releasing a collection of queer hymns, formerly Songs for the Holy Other, Hymns Affirming the LGBTQIA2S+ Community. Quote from Breitbart. Among the nearly 50 queer hymns featured in the collection are God of Queer Transgressive Spaces, Lovely Needy People, Quirky, Queer and Wonderful, and The Kingdom of God is the Queerest of Nations. End quote. I don't see the need for new hymns. Couldn't they just have adapted some of the old ones? A tweak here and there to hymns ancient and modern, and you have something for the LGBTQIA2S pluses. I'll get the ball rolling. How about Queerer My God to Thee? Or How Fabulous Thou Art? Songs of Thankfulness and Gaze? Although, if it's up to me, I think that the old rugged cross should be left just as it is. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening, and rest assured, please, that you will be, ladies and gentlemen, to Radio Derb, until officers from the Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice kick down my door and drag me off for re-education. Okay, some sign-off music. This is an oldie, but I beg your indulgence. I am a 60s survivor, and I occasionally look back wistfully across these past 5 decades to the world of my younger self. Now, I won't deny that Western Civ took a wrong turn in the 60s. Several wrong turns, in fact. The 1965 Immigration Act being one of the wrongest. And when it wasn't being plain wrong, the world of the 60s was being silly in an aimless and civilizationally unproductive way. It was my youth, though, and for all the silliness and wrong-headedness swirling around back then, I can't help but nurse nostalgia. Certain names, certain images, certain movies. Well, enough with the excuses. The movie Midnight Cowboy was released in Britain September 25th, 1969. I was living in London, and I went to see it at one of the West End theatres soon after the release, which is to say just about exactly 50 years ago. So here, for all you other 60s survivors, and anyone else who likes a decently well-crafted pop song, with that 60s flavour of what I think can fairly be called creative self-absorption, here is Harry Nilsson. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going well, the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze. And skipping over the ocean like a stone.